Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. All very excited here. Who have we got on, Alex?
Oh, I'm really excited today. We have Catherine Schofield with us today. She's a senior lecturer in South Asian music and history at King's College London. Hi, Catherine.
Hi there, how you doing?
Oh, I'm so glad you got in touch because we've got an excellent topic today. Tell everyone what we're going to talk about.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the history of Indian courtesans. South Asia, what is now India and Pakistan and Bangladesh, and the amazing women singers, dancers, artists, literateurs who were the really the only main public women figures that you would see in male space. And yes, they also had sexual relations with their patrons.
And we get to trash the East India Company a bit, don't we?
We do
Boom.
because, yes, a lot of things that the East India Company did in the 19th and 20th century has meant that the courtesan tradition, it's not died out, but it has struggled to survive.
So let's start by telling everyone, what do you mean by the term Indian courtesans? It's a really good time to talk about them, isn't it?
Oh,
It's
yeah.
suddenly become relevant again.
It has become very relevant, and not least because those of you who have been watching the new Meera Nair BBC adaptation of Vikram Seth's novel A Suitable Boy will have noticed that a very prominent, very starry character is an Indian courtesan called Saeedabai, played by the great Indian actress Tabu. And she is gorgeous, she is glamorous, she is also, for those of you who remember the book, and I'm not going to give any spoilers for those of you who've read the book or yet for the series. She is also quite melancholy, and it's quite a tragic tale there. And she is the classic North Indian courtesan. They were also called Tawaif or Baijis. So Bai was an honorific term that you would give to a great performer, singer, dancer. They were known for their wit. They were known for their mastery of etiquette, of conduct, and so on. In the south, in South India, there was another community of courtesans called Devadasis. And these women were married to the deity in Hindu temples. So they were dedicated by their families to the service of the god as young girls. And they danced in the temple for the deity, but they were also hired by the ruler or the patrons of the temple to dance for them. And they also sometimes performed as salon performers, and again also provided sexual pleasure outside marital bonds. So the crucial thing here is actually the difference between courtesans and wives or concubines. So wives and concubines before the 20th century, they were responsible for shoring up the dynasty, for producing heirs to the dynasty. We're talking about elite women here. And because of that, they were kept in segregated in the women's quarters or the zenana or the harem. And they could be really well educated and have a big political role to play. One Mughal wife was governor of Delhi, for example, for a time. But they stayed in private to ensure that the dynasty was intact. Courtesans, on the other hand, had to stay outside the harem, and they performed in male space as public figures. And so you have, going way back to ancient Indian times, the development of matrilineal lineages, matrilineal hereditary professional women, where the mothers and daughters would perform, but they would not marry. And so they could be in public and perform. And their sons and their the men folk of the tradition would accompany them on musical instruments, and some of them would be indentured out to other trades like carpentry or whatever. So you've got this separation of two different types of women, both of them thoroughly respected, but really quite different and separate. That was a long answer.
So culturally, how important are courtesans in India? Because they span a huge period, don't they? Yeah. And how is their world structured?
Okay, so starting from the ancient times, so some of you will be familiar with a little book called the Kama Sutra. Mm-hmm. And contrary to popular belief, this great Sanskrit work by Vatsyayana, which was written around about the third century of the Common Era, is in fact largely a manual of statecraft and etiquette rather than a sex treatise. So there is a section on the arts of sex, obviously. That's the bit that the colonizers pulled out and made more seductive and amazing by, you know, introducing pictures and things. Mm-hmm. But there's this big section before you get to that stuff on the role of the courtesan and what the courtesan has to do. So Vatsyayana advises that the courtesan has to be skilled in all 64 arts that define a cultured person. And so he lists them all in this incredibly daunting list: singing, playing on musical instruments, dancing, writing, drawing, picture making, trimming, decorating, knowledge of magic, tailoring, carpentry, architecture, chemistry, mineralogy, cock, quail, and ram fighting. The rules of society, how to pay respect, etiquette, and so forth. And a courtesan who had all of these became known as a Ganika. And they played these incredibly important public roles in ancient India as dancers, singers, bearers of high culture, and of course, bedmates. And it's important to remember that pleasure was a really important, had a really important place in Hindu thought, in ancient Hindu thought. As a one of the virtues that men and women should strive for. We also know a little bit about their education and the fact that the state paid for the Ganika's education. And so they were taught, again, to sing, to play on the veena, which is a stringed instrument, flutes, drums. They were taught to write, recite, dance, act, paint, read the thoughts of others, manufacture scents and garlands of flowers. They were taught the art of shampooing, which was not washing your hair, but actually massage. Mm-hmm. And of course, the art of attracting others, the arts of seduction. So, you know, this huge set of things, that list was from another text called the Artashastra, which is about the 7th century CE, again in Sanskrit. So in terms of social life, we know that they were effectively the property of the state if they were elite courtesans. So they were at the beck of the and call of the Raja or Lord of the domain. And many cities and courts had courtesan quarters attached to them where courtesans lived with their entourages and with all the people who supplied them with makeup and jewelry and their musicians and so on. Hopefully we're going to see some of those scenes in A Suitable Boy for a much later time period.
I'm just reading Alina's mind here. Her mind went straight to entourage, diamonds, jewels. Oh, I want to be goodness. A courtesan, but then was quickly scuppered by the fact that she is absolutely tone deaf.
Yeah. Well, you could have been one of those courtesans who majored in dance because there was
there you go.
A different. I can't dance either.
This is a bit later. We're going to skip now to the 18th century and to courtesans that the East India Company might have been a bit more familiar with. But they danced in these troupes of dancers and singers. And the younger ones, the unmarried ones, the virgins, the ones who were, you know, you could pay a lot of money to, you know, deflower. They were dancers. They did the dancing. And some of them would sing a little bit while they danced. But the main meat of the program and the more higher respect was given to this was for the older women who had maybe had a few babies by this time, maybe a little bit rounder in the belly, perhaps a little bit less lithe. They would sing, and of course your voice matures through your 20s into your 30s, and so their voices were much better at an older age. So you could have been one of those young things, you know, with your beautiful ankle bells and your jewels and your, you know, sort of tossing your hair and your, you know, jangling earrings and everything else as you danced, and then perhaps, I don't know, go off and have babies.
You know what, though? It's striking me already. There is nothing remotely slutty about being an Indian courtesan, is there? It's not like a sordid, like, occupation frowned upon morally.
Not at all. So in the 18th century and early 19th century, you have all of these descriptions by European travellers, women and men, who are shocked to find that the dancers are not at all immoral.
Yeah. And
they make this comment that it's primarily a sort of waving of the drapery and little pirouettes and little walks, and what's the most seductive thing is the way they look at the men, sort of sidelong out of their eyes and so on. So they're actually quite, you know, they've been told about the Indian march and how racy it is, and they suddenly discover that actually it's really quite modest in comparison to ballerinas on the operatic stage in London or Paris at the end of the 18th, early 19th century.
We're using it as quite an all-encompassing term, courtesan, but there are many different kinds, aren't there? You've already mentioned the elite ones that do the whole list.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different types of courtesans, and this is because there were an awful lot of matrilineal communities with various different caste names who specialized in different things and specialized in different areas. And you have everything from these top courtesans. So the Kanchani, the golden ones, the gilded ones, who were employed at the Mughal court and who eventually got subsumed under this kind of umbrella term, tawaif, as the primary Muslim courtesans. But then you have other courtesans, let's say, attached to the Rajput courts, called Bhagtan, which actually comes from a kind of a devotional word to meaning devotee. And they both performed in the court and in the temples of the court. But they were also actually allowed, more unusually, to enter the harem and teach the women of the house, the secluded women, music and dance. So they were quite different. But then you've got things all the way down to people who had the name Randi or Kaspi, which in modern Hindi are, you know, really quite offensive words
for,
you know, just sex workers, so there were a number of women whose life whose careers were more along the lines of largely sex work with some music and dancing, absolutely no stigma to those women at all. There was no stigma at all to women who performed primarily sex work and who, you know, it was all dependent on what your particular skills were and also how much you were worth and which strata of society you were performing for. It's also worthwhile noting that there were male courtesans. Mm-hmm. And this is much less well known. They weren't called courtesans, but a number of younger men who danced in these hereditary communities, particularly Bhans and Baharupias, also performed roles as courtesans for the male elite. And it's really important, again, to remember that before colonialism, same-sex love and same-sex, having sex with another man was regarded as completely acceptable for Mughal men, for Rajput men, Hindu and Muslim, as long as there was a status distinction between the two men that was observed. They were much more wary about relationships that might have the potential to topple political status quo. You know, you weren't supposed to get too addicted to your courtesan, right? You know, if you got too addicted to either your male or female courtesan, and they ask for political favors or try to get you to marry them, then that might cause political ructions.
Oh, we're back to, we've just done a three-parter on Austria-Hungary in the First World War. Count von Hotzendorf basically smashing up the Austrian army to try and impress his mistress.
Yeah, it's very, they would have loved that. So the historical chronicle writers would have gone to town with that story.
Yeah.
And they would have made it, the man would have been seduced by, not so much by the courtesan herself, but by his base instinct, his desire for music, for pleasure, for dance, for wine, for sex. And he pours all of that desire into this one woman or one man who dances and sings for him. And they encourage him to abandon his duty. And his fate, always in the historical chronicles, is that he will lose his kingdom or he will lose his life. And it's really not a story about courtesans at all, because they disappear from the story. You don't know what happens to them.
Yeah.
And this story then gets repeated and repeated right down to the 20th century and to some of the stories. You know, those of you who are watching A Suitable Boy, watch out for this story, this cautionary tale about courtesans in the character of Saida Bai.
So some of these courtesans rise to positions of huge power, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I'll give you one example. So there was this amazing courtesan, probably from Lucknow, who started life as a woman called Farzana Zebunissa. And it's slightly unclear what her background was. Some people claim that she was Circassian, so from the Caucasus, but it was really common for fair-skinned, because fair-skinned, of course, was regarded as more lovely. It was the same old boring racist story. But they often purported to be Kashmirian or Circassian when they came into North India, because, coming from, Jalandhar or something like that was just nowhere near as glamorous as...
I love that you mentioned Jalandhar, because that's where my best friend is from. Oh, Jalandhar, not glamorous at all.
Yeah, no shade on Jalandhar. It's amazing. So they would pretend to come from these places. So it's not really clear whether she really was Circassian, but she was picked up in Lucknow by a European mercenary, a Swiss mercenary, Luxembourgian mercenary called Walter Reinhardt, who always dressed in black. And so he was known as Somba, which became in Hindi and Urdu, Samru. And she married him, or what became his mistress, and she became known as Begum Samru. Her story is fascinating. Eventually, he fights his way up to having, quite a large mercenary army, and then he dies. And she takes over the army. And she starts building her own power base at a place called Sardhana, which is just north of Delhi, about 3 hours drive by car, very close to Meerut, where, those of you who know your Indian history, that's where the Indian uprising of 1857 happened, about 20 years after she died, after Begum Samru died. And she set up a power base there, and she used her mercenary army to help protect the Mughal emperor in Delhi. So firstly, Shah Alam II, who treated her like a daughter, and he was blinded gruesomely by an Afghan marauder in 1788, and was really at this point simply a figurehead for Maratha control of the region. But Begum Samru also supported him with her army, and she continued to support his successor, Akbar Shah, when he came to the throne in 1806. She was very well respected by the British for the role of her army in helping to quell disorder in the region, because it was actually very, the region around Delhi was really very unsafe and quite wild in the early 19th century. And she converted to Catholicism, and she built this massive basilica, which is still there, on grand European style. And throughout this time, she herself patronized courtesans and Hindustani classical music and poets who would all come to Sardana or would go to her. She also had a haveli, a palace in Delhi, and they would come to her palace and they would perform there for her. And her successor, a man called David Ochterlony Dasumri, became the first Indian to enter the British Parliament in 1841.
I really like her.
Yeah, she's
cool.
Awesome. She was awesome. And really, you know, and she was tiny. She was
really,
yeah. There's a really fantastic painting of her. I think it's in the British Library, surrounded by her entourage, and various Europeans also paying court to her and British soldiers and so on. And she's this tiny, tiny little elderly woman. She must've been about 4'6" or something, size of my 10-year-old. Yeah. And what a woman.
Never mess with an Indian granny.
Absolutely not. No way.
I'm going to chuck another name at you.
Yeah.
One that I think I can't remember if it was before we started recording. Malika Bai Chandar.
Oh, yeah.
Who is she?
So she is another extraordinary figure. Not so much as a political figure, but as an extremely important cultural figure. So Malika Bai Chandar her family were originally from Ahmedabad in Gujarat, and her mother was abandoned by her father in the great upheaval of the 18th century, of the middle of the 18th century, and they were left to fend for themselves. And so they tagged on to a group of Bhaktans. So if you remember, I mentioned the Bhaktans, who were the employees of the Rajput rulers and who performed, and this group of Bhaktans taught Malika Bai Chandar's mother to sing and dance. And so they started moving as itinerants to south, and they ended up in the entourage of Nizamul Mulk, who became the first independent ruler of Hyderabad. Hyderabad eventually became the biggest and wealthiest princely state. And so they made their way to the Deccan and then to Hyderabad with the Nizams. And Malika Bai then successfully became the mistress of a Maratha general called Raja Rao Rampal. Two prime ministers of the Nizams, the second Nizam of Hyderabad. her claim to fame, her two claims to fame, firstly, is that she's recognized as the first really fabulous Urdu poet.
Yeah.
Who produced a diwan or book of her own poetry in Urdu. Her Ghazal poetry, and secondly, because in the middle of a dance and song extravaganza to celebrate the defeat of Tipu Sultan by the combined forces of the British and Hyderabad in 1799, she pirouetted right up to John Malcolm, who was a member of the residency staff at the time, and presented her book of poetry to him in the middle of this notch. And he slipped it into his breast pocket and took it home with him. And it ended up in what are now the India Office collections in the British Library. So you can go and have a look.
Oh, brilliant.
It's an amazing little artifact. But she was really extraordinary. But the other thing that was interesting about her was that she, in a complete reversal of her fortunes, she never married. She had a massive mansion where she trained her girls in the arts of dance and song and seduction. She built her mother and herself a beautiful tomb. She endowed all these religious buildings on the hill of Maula Ali Shrine in Hyderabad. And she also had behind her a man. So there's usually, it's usually the other way around, isn't it? You know, the joke about, you know, behind every man, there is a, you know, an extremely organized, you know, brilliant woman, behind a great man. Well, in this case, behind this great woman, there was this older man who was a hereditary musician from Delhi, descended from the top, the legendary musicians of Delhi. Those of you who know your Indian music history will recognize the names of Tansen and Sadarang, and he was descended jointly from those two. And he was her music teacher and mentor, and he became like a father figure to her. So he was an anchor, really. So he was technically in her employ. He lived with her in her house, but it was he, I think he was the only man she could really trust to care about her as for who she was.
Not try and sleep with her.
Not try to sleep with her. No political games.
Yeah.
And they were both appear to have been Shia Muslims and joined in their devotion to Hazrat Ali and the family of Hazrat Ali. So really interesting story.
Tell us how Sophia Plowden has contributed to your research.
Okay, so this is another courtesan story. So we're moving back to Lucknow. So this is slightly earlier than Malakabai. So Malakabai dies in 1824. And so we're moving back to 1788 to Lucknow. And in the 1780s, there was a real fashion amongst English women in stuck in India with nothing to do with their husbands, to run around and collect the songs of courtesans, of the great to wife whose performance they were invited to by the local rulers or the local, you know, wealthy merchant or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was similar to the fashion for running around and collecting Scottish songs or Irish songs, or which is the similar time period. And so she went to Lucknow twice with her husband, who was an East India Company official. And she collected songs there, which she then took back to sing herself at masquerades, dressed in the dress of a courtesan, which she describes in minute details in one of her letters in the British Library, singing the songs in their original language, even though she didn't really understand the language at all. And then when she went back in 1788, she collected these songs. And when she went back in 1788, there was a massive star who just turned up called Khanum Jan. And Khanum Jan had grown to popularity actually in the British cantonment in nearby Kanpur, where there's even a satirical poem about her leaving and how devastated everybody is in English, leaving Kanpur to go to the much more prestigious court of the Nawab of Lucknow, the ruler of independent Lucknow. And Lucknow in the 18th and 19th centuries was the byword for the best of late Mughal culture. Everything was the best there.
Okay.
And so she became the star turn in Lucknow. And Sophia Plowden and Khanum Jan struck up this very interesting professional relationship where Khanum Jan would come to Plowden's house and sing to her, and Plowden would write down the tunes of the songs, and she would get her secretary, her munshi, to write out the Persian and Urdu and Punjabi and Hindi lyrics, so that she would then be able to sing these songs for herself. And these we still have. So we actually know what some of these songs sounded like, which is quite remarkable. But from the other point of view, another thing about Lucknow courtesans was that in this time period, late 18th, early 19th century, it's quite clear that their most important both friendships and sexual relationships were with each other, which with other tawaif. This
I was going to ask you, what is recti? Is it recti? Okay. Is that how you say it?
Recti. Okay. Yeah. So there is this genre of Urdu poetry or song lyric called recti. So there are these. So some of you may have heard of the Urdu ghazal, which is this couplet-like form, which has a kind of A-A-B-A structure like a European aria. So these were kind of recognizable musically, sort of, to Europeans. So they quite liked them, and they liked listening to them, and they liked trying to sing them themselves. There is another genre which is essentially the same form, but instead of with the Urdu ghazal it being a man writing about a woman, or possibly another man, because gender is ambiguous in the Urdu ghazal, it's a woman writing about, in women's language, often the language of courtesans, often about another woman. So you have these rehtis, which talk in quite explicit detail about sexual relationships between courtesans. And there's a particularly nice one from the late 18th century by a poet called Rangin, who was famous for writing some of the most racy rehtis, in which a woman upbraids her lesbian lover. So the lesbian lover was the term Zanahi. Oh, Zanahi, ever since you heard the keyboard play, you have become obsessed with a foreign woman. So here you have a situation where it's quite possible, it's conceivably possible that Khanum Jan actually had a big crush on Sophia Plowden. And we have a painting of Sophia Plowden from approximately this time, a little bit later in London, where she really was actually quite an attractive woman. So, you know, and she would have had that, you know, lovely fair skin. Which
this is true, fairer than all of them.
Yes. So, yeah.
And so, is it just so, in terms of, you're saying, the most important relationships with each other, that's emotionally as well, essentially.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The most important emotional, social and sexual relationships were with each other. And there's a great article by a woman called Vina Oldenburg. She went and talked to some of the daughters and still practicing Tawaifs in Lucknow in the late 60s, early 70s. And they talk very freely about their own relationships with each other and about the kinds of language that women use when they make love to other women in this time period. So,
how do courtesans come into events surrounding the uprising in 1857?
Yeah, okay. So they actually play quite an important role. So, you know, I've just been talking about Vina Oldenburg's work looking at modern day courtesans. And she actually came to this because when she was looking at Lucknow in the mid to late 19th century, and particularly looking at the effect of the Indian uprising on Lucknow's culture, because Lucknow was devastated by the uprising, she picked up the fact that the Tawaifs in Lucknow were all in the highest tax brackets. And the reason we know this is because the British punished them for assisting the rebels. So a number of the most prominent courtesans throughout North India. So just to backtrack a little bit for those who don't know about the Indian uprising, in 1857, the East India Company tried to force their Indian soldiers, Muslims and Hindus, to use the new rifle cartridges, which required them to tear greased cartridges with their teeth. Rumors flew around that these cartridges had been greased with pork and beef fat. And of course, cows are holy to Hindus and pigs are forbidden for Muslims. There's a whole other pile of things that went in. This was merely the trigger for the uprising.
Yeah, but it was horrific, wasn't it?
And it was absolutely horrific. And the stories are horrific. And India went up in flames, particularly in the north, for a period of over 12 months into 1858. And Lucknow is one of the main centres for this. In Meerut, just before this all started, just before the first mutineers mutinied, there was a lot of going backwards and forwards about this. And the courtesans and prostitutes in Meerut goaded those who had chosen to bite the cartridges for having done so and for being anti-patriotic. And they were also acting, as the ancient courtesans did way back when, as secret messengers between between various players in the uprising. And so they were really important in the first sparks that set the uprising off. But also, when you get to the Lucknow courtesans and the really wealthy ones, they were funding it. They Wow. were funding it with their all their jewels and money and so on. But of course, if you think about it, and you know, a number of people have done work on this, these women were having sex with both East India Company officers and with Indians of various statuses. And they could actually act very nicely as spies.
Yeah.
On one side or another. And so you and there's you know, I mean, there are all sorts of different situations that a lot of these women were in. So a number of them were camp followers of the East India Company armies, but there were a whole pile who were not. And so it's a really, they played a really interesting role there.
That's insane. And we love socking it to the East India Company on History Hack, because they are absolute shitbags, for want of a better description. Yep. But when, so they go down in flames after the Indian Mutiny, yes, and the British government move in, and they are essentially done. And now the East India Company is a shop somewhere in London, isn't it, that sells, I can't remember what they sell. That is at the end of William's
very
book.
Expensive tea.
That's it, expensive tea. I love that William used that as the last line in his book, just to sort of give them the finger. But exactly. The downfall of the East India Company didn't mean good things for the courtesans either. Why is that?
No, it isn't. It didn't. So before 1857, actually, the courtesans and other sex workers, you know, of all shades and sizes and varieties, played a really important role in the company, as well as in amongst Indian patrons, you know, as performers, as camp followers, as I've just said, what was called the Lal Bazaar, the Red Bazaar that followed the army, a number of courtesans and ordinary sex workers were employed in the East India Company armies and went to places like Singapore and Penang with the armies. Mm. And we've got really interesting information about them from some of the newspapers at the time there. But what happens is that actually gradually over the 19th century, you get this hardening of attitudes towards the patronage of Indian arts. So, you know,
so this essentially happens, isn't it, is that the Victorians come in and crap all over centuries of tradition and put their mean-spirited British Christian plant on it, and it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's not quite the beginning of the end. So what happens is that you get this increase in, you know, you get this drop-off in Europeans who are willing to patronise Indian music and dance, though there are still some. And I mean, you know, men are men.
Yeah. Men still want sex.
Yeah, exactly. But after 1857, the East India Company gets rightfully booted out because they made such a dreadful hash of things.
Yeah. See you later.
Bye bye. And Crown Law comes in, which means that Acts of Parliament passed in Britain by and large have to be, you know, exported to the colonies. And the first acts that have an effect here are firstly the criminalization of homosexuality, which means that a number of the male, I've been calling them courtesans, but that, you know, they're, you know, buns and things are, you know, they're overnight, their activities are criminalized. The 1864 Contagious Diseases Act, I know it's very thrilling, which was brought in to protect actually all British Army soldiers from venereal disease.
From themselves, basically.
Yeah, basically. So these were regulations that were brought in to put diseased sex workers into lock hospitals so that they didn't infect the army officers and soldiers, ordinary soldiers. And these were brought in India as well. And overnight, these amazing prima donnas. I mean, they, you know, think of, they were always referred to in the 1820s by Europeans as the Catalanis of India. And Angelica Catalani was this amazing opera diva in London. In the late 18th century. So you've got these great, amazing opera divas who are then treated by the British legislation as prostitutes. As and this word comes
slutty people, basically.
And so you get this conflation of the word tawaif with the word prostitute, this kind of moralization, this moral stigma against women in various kinds of sex work. And then on top of that, in the late 19th century, almost all of the matrilineal communities, hereditary communities of professional courtesans are notified by the British government in India as what are called criminal tribes. And this was largely to do with the fact that a lot of these communities, the ones that weren't indentured in a particular court, were itinerant. They traveled from place to place. Even, and some of the top artists, the Derrida tawaif, traveled from place to place to perform. And they were all notified as criminal tribes because they were itinerant, because vagrancy was a really big issue in British legislation at the time. And this increased kind of moral stigma from the burgeoning Indian middle and upper middle classes who rose to political and cultural prominence in the Victorian era in India. And so from the 1890s onwards, you get Indians writing into the newspapers, setting up what is called the anti-Nautch movement, which is saying that the arts of singing and dance are entirely in the hands of women of ill repute. And men should not be going to these women of ill repute. And these art forms are too precious to leave to these people. So what we need to do is we need to rescue these forms so that respectable women can learn to please their husbands at home with their singing, a little bit like playing the piano in Victorian England. And this is what happened through the first decades of the 20th century. You have these music reformers and dance reformers who take the classical dances and classical song genres performed by tawaif in the north and devadasis in the south, and turn them into, for the north, Kathak dance, which was also performed by male performers, of course, as well, and Bharatanatyam dance in the south. And so these two forms actually come from courtesan traditions, but they take the art away and give it to respectable Brahmin, upper class, upper caste, young women and men to perform. And so the Devadasis themselves become, you know, pushed into different directions. And this all ends, just at the point of independence and afterwards, when there is the 1947 Devadasi Prevention of Dedication Act, which makes being a Devadasi illegal in the south in Tamil Nadu. And then in 1951, All India Radio puts a broadcast ban on any woman whose, quote, private life was a public scandal, unquote. And so tawaif and Devadasi, all those who could be identified as such, were banned from the radio and sent to the margins of cultural life.
And yet.
Yeah.
And yet they've segued into, those hereditary lines are still there, aren't they? And they've segued into the recording industry and, what we call Bollywood.
That's right. So this sounds like this is terribly depressing story, the courtesan tale where it just ends in the courtesan disappearing from the story. No, these were extraordinarily entrepreneurial women. And throughout the late 19th century and early 20th century, the best and cleverest elite tawaifs and devadasis actually took advantage of rapid developments in technology, in urbanization, and particularly celebrity culture, print culture, to make names for themselves on the public stage. So you have them being photographed, and you have, you know, programs, and you have, you know, all of these things. And so they it's women from these communities, because these are the only women who are allowed to perform in public. They become pioneers as singing actresses on the Calcutta theatre stage in the 19th century. And then in 1902, the International Gramophone Company turns up on its first international recording expedition in India. And the first people they can get to perform for them are the Tawaif, and particularly a famous one, a woman called Goha Jan. And there's a book on her life, actually. And they would sing these 3-minute discs, because that's all the space you had. And at the end, she would say, Miram Gohajan hai. So my name is Gohajan. And she was, in fact, from a mixed Indian-Armenian Jewish background, and she could sing in multiple languages. And she became a massive star through gramophone recordings, because once you separate the Tawaf's body from her voice, the voice can enter respectable spaces on the gramophone recording. And so she kind of made a huge name for herself as a star that way. And then, of course, they become the first stars on the radio. They become the first actresses in silent film. And then, of course, the first singing actresses in the Hindi cinema industry from 1931. And some of the playback, which, normally in Bollywood, you separate the voice of the singer from the body and acting of the actress. Mm. That didn't really come in until the late 40s. So you had to have actresses who could sing and who were willing to appear acting and singing and dancing at the same time.
It's not perfect. Easy.
Perfect. So you have these two amazing singers, two of the best singers of the 20th century, who are renowned for their classical music and their devotional music, but who used this technology to transition from being a Tawaif, in the case of Begum Akhtar, and from being the daughter of a Devadasi, in the case of M.S. Subbalakshmi, to being these unassailable musical celebrities, garnered, you know, huge national and international accolades, and highly decorated and most beloved singers of the 20th century. And they used this transition to get there. They were both born within 2 years of each other. Begum Akhtar, born as Akhtaribai Faizabadi in 1914, and M.S. Subbalakshmi in Chennai in 2016. That's not 2016,
19. I was going to say, she's young.
Very young, she's 4 years old. Begum Akhtar died in 1974, and M.S. Subbalakshmi in 2000.
I like it. It's a victory. Yeah.
It's great.
Despite the Victorians and the East India Company and all of the crap that Britain laid at India's door, that part of culture has survived.
Absolutely, it did survive. And actually, even still today, there's a lot of talk about how sad and desperate and terrible the lives of bar girls are in Bombay and how they're exploited and so on. In fact, most of those women come from the same matrilineal hereditary communities that have been around for 1,000+ years, the Nauts, the Beriyas, the Kanchani, and they are still performing dance to make a living beautifully as dancing bar girls in the bars in Mumbai.
Awesome.
So they've made that transition.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us and telling us all about Indian courtesans, wives, and mistresses, concubines, I'm trying to make this long list here, and it's not coming out very well, but thank you so much for joining us anyway.
My absolute pleasure. It's a delight to talk to you.
Join us a bit later for Back Chat. Once again, Alina and I will be discussing some burningly non-important question in history and being rather silly. And then join us on Monday when David Davis will be back. This is the author of the Quinton Journals. He came on before to tell us all about Charles Stewart's Navy. He's going to explain to us from start to finish the Spanish Armada. So don't miss that one, because it's an epic, brilliant event in British history. But we find out exactly what happened, why the Spanish were routed, and whether we actually deserve any credit at all.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.